I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground. 2022 has been a year dominated by the brutal proxy war in Ukraine and an entire geopolitical realignment minimized in censored NATO nation media and celebrated across the global south. The scale of the brutality may for now be lost in the mists of the fog of war, but we do know that billions of dollars worth of weapons are being poured into Ukraine. Both NATO and Russia emphasize the humanity of their actions. So how are ethics and the idea of humanity in war playing a part in modern conflict? And are they in fact catalysts? Well, joining me now from Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, to talk about transformations in the humanity of wars is Professor Samuel Moyne. He's the Chancellor Kent Professor of Law and History at Yale and author of the book Humane: How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War. Thank you so much, Professor Moyne, for coming on the show. I better start then with the fact that though we don't know in detail what the Kremlin strategy is in Ukraine, given the slow progress, sometimes fast progress, again, it is the fog of war, how you think the idea of humane war may be affecting Kremlin policy, much as you have written about it, affecting Washington policy?
Well, I'm no expert, but from what I've seen, at least in the initial weeks of the war, it seemed as if the Russian audience really did care about the reassurances given by the Kremlin that the fighting was humane. And that's changed a bit, and not least because of the use of missiles on which Vladimir Putin showed more restraint at the beginning of the war than lately. But I think that the main way the idea of humane war is playing out is on the Western side, since from the beginning there's been a pronounced discourse of Russian atrocity. And I think that's done a lot to affect the way that Westerners think about the war. And I've just tried to argue in my work that though there are old roots to concerns about atrocity and war, the intensity of those concerns is something new, and the way that they have affected warfare is very recent. And so we're in a new situation in which statesmen really do care about the humanity of their wars because global audiences expect war to be fought more humanely and demand it.
So it is a kind of PR and a media element and dimension to this, rather than codified human rights law as per Geneva Conventions and UN Security Council, UN Charter elements.
Well, the UN Charter says nothing about the ways war should be fought. It tries to control aggression. And of course, both the West and Russia have engaged in illegal war, in starting wars. But these other bodies of law, I think, do matter. The Geneva Conventions and especially later bodies of law like the 1977 revisions to the Geneva Convention, which, for example, prohibit excess casualties of civilians, even when states target combatants. I would say that those laws do matter. But they matter because of changing public expectations. And of course, media have a lot to do with public knowledge of what's going on in the field, as well as, you know, the spread of distorted understandings of what's happening. In the old days, media was central to war frenzy. And in fact, most often communicated to an enthusiastic public for war that brutality was going on. And nowadays, brutality is reported to horrify audiences for war. And of course, that's measured by these laws. And so the laws still are part of the picture, but I don't think that they come first. They're more reflections of growing concern for how war is fought. And therefore, politicians are forced to fight differently and order different kinds of wars than they did in even the recent past.
Albeit that it's kind of unprecedented, the censorship of media in NATO nations this time around. There are calls for CGTN, the Chinese channel, to be banned across Europe. RT is banned. The Iranian channel is banned. I know your book, Humane, talks about seismic events like the covering of My Lai and Abu Ghraib. Cy Hirsch has been a guest on this show. Medea Benjamin, another figure that you mentioned in the peace movement in the US, again, a kind of regular on this show, as is Richard Falk been. Ironic that you didn't mention Ukraine in the book, but you did mention a Russian, in particular, Prince Andrei, the character in War and Peace by Tolstoy. Just remind us why that character exposes such a tension today in the midst of this Ukraine war.
Well, the Count Tolstoy went to war as a young man, actually, in the Crimea. When he wrote War and Peace a couple of years later, he dramatized this new project of Swiss origin, of using laws to make war humane. And he had one of his immortal characters, Prince Andrei, reject making war humane on the grounds that humane war would be more tolerable for more people, and in a way obscure the real evil, at least most of the time, of going to war. Now, as Tolstoy lived on, I think he perfected his argument in this regard, because Prince Andrew in the novel actually suggests that war should be left brutal, because then people would know what they're allowing their states to do. I'm not sure we should take that view. But I do think Tolstoy, as he matured, was right that every time we press for more humanity in warfare, we're incurring the risk that it will be easier to go to war and easier to sustain war, as of course the parties to the Ukraine war are currently doing, making it something that is seemingly interminable.
Yes, I mean, Professor Moyne, I know secretly you don't favour Prince Andrei's view because you don't want brutality, I'm sure. But I suppose I can't resist saying that there's a Yale professor there, the Brady Johnson Distinguished Professor at Yale is none other than Victoria Nuland. I don't know whether you meet her in the corridors at Yale University, who was clearly secretly plotting in Ukraine. We have the leaked phone call. Is there a case for saying that the brutality is now concealed? I mean, it always has been to an extent, which is why Seymour Hersh takes and had to take such pains in trying to expose what happened in My Lai in Vietnam. But there's that secret brutality that goes behind this curtain of UN resolutions and let alone historic conventions.
Well, obscurity and secrecy cloaks both the origins of war and then how it's conducted. And you're totally right that states have an interest in secrecy, in keeping gory photos, in the case of My Lai and later Abu Ghraib, from the public. But it's also important to understand that once information gets out, it can end up helping statesmen reset wars. And I emphasize in my work that American politicians like Barack Obama understood that making the war on terror more humane could make it more sustainable, precisely because the information that, you know, was eventually so well publicized about detainee abuse and even torture had so offended the global public and even the American public. And what Barack Obama did is reset the war on terror by making it less brutal and promising that it would be conducted more humanely. Now, you raise secrecy in the origins of war, and I can't comment on this particular war because—
You haven't met Victoria Nuland in the corridor then.
I have not met her. I don't believe she's serving right now, but of course she has been a central figure in two democratic administrations in Ukraine policy. And of course, the origins of this war are not simple, but I don't think we will know for many years, precisely because of the secrecy you mentioned, who said what, who authorized what, who's to blame, although clearly we wouldn't want to exempt Vladimir Putin from his illegal action of crossing a sovereign state's border in the flagrant way he did, especially when on the eve of the invasion, Putin himself complained about the illegality of Western actions, giving a very, in a way, persuasive litany of all the times Western governments, including the American one, have gone to war illegally, irrespective of how they've gone on to fight these wars.
Of course, from their perspective, it might have been military strategy, and from their perspective, it's the Minsk Accords, authorized in UN Security Council Resolution 2202, that was violated, which gives them that excuse, let alone the biowarfare program. I should just say, as regards what you said about Obama, but much of what you write about there in the book against, de facto against Obama, I don't think is known by many in NATO nation media. We say hi to the 35 Guantanamo prisoners still there. If they're watching this program, as we understand from lawyers, actually. But I have to say that your work is avowedly disinterested and scholarly. But I did note that you used to work in the belly of the beast where power was as an intern. As you've studied and as your scholarly work has progressed, how do you look back being an intern in the White House? I understand you were there when secrecy and media manipulation was all there because it was about the war on NATO war on Yugoslavia.
That's right. I served as a lowly intern in the National Security Council at the time of the bombing of Belgrade and Serbia. And of course, there is always secrecy in military operations and selective ways of informing the public to make your side look better. I do think in the aftermath of that experience, I became much more skeptical of great power militarism in general. And the origins of my own work are not in particular in the critique of that war, with which I was, associated as a youth, but much more concerned about the failure of humanity to fulfill Tolstoy's dream of a more peaceful world. And I think that is why I spend so much attention looking at the formation of the United Nations the origins of the original contest between the West and the Soviet Union, and why it was that we've ended up with an international law that in practice exempts great powers like the United States and Russia from any real controls on the initiation of war.
Professor Samuel Moyne, I'll stop you there. More from Yale University's Chancellor Kent Professor of Law and History after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Professor Samuel Moyne, Yale University's Chancellor Kent Professor of Law and History, and author of the book Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War. I detect in your work one key element is the bottom-up way that society can change and transform rather than supranational treaty and convention. But, of course, Yugoslavia is iconic in the global south. It's certainly iconic to Beijing, where their embassy, of course, was bombed in Yugoslavia, let alone to Russia, which was supporting Serbia. Do you think, then, that also your critiques of recent critiques of Putin's policy, to an extent, what you're saying is he shouldn't have done this, and from what their perspective is, defended the people of Luhansk and Donetsk, because he's undermined the peace movement in Western countries. I mean, that's what you're saying to an extent.
I think that's right. I mean, apart from whether it was a gross strategic error on Putin's part, it seems as if he on the basis of his very strong critique of Western illegality, a series of illegal wars, has in the end added insult to injury by declaring yet another.
But if we're to take that to one extent, it does sound ironic then that if the Z sign is appearing in favelas in Brazil, and Russia's going in to defend Luhansk and Donetsk as the much of the global South has seen it at the UN resolution that was made, the representatives representing most of humanity were against the EU and the US arguable proxies. You're literally saying, oh, but the peace movement in NATO countries, we need to protect them, and they've destroyed all the work they've done and arguably failed at, while the whole of the global South is now talking BRICS and Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Doesn't it just mean actually the EU and the US, you know, forget them? That's what the Putin action has really signaled.
I think the response of the global South is quite interesting. It's worth remembering that in the beginning, there was a near universal condemnation by the General Assembly of any annexationist war. But you're entirely right that we should ponder the response of the Global South, which I read a little differently. I think it reflects a pox on both their houses and just fatigue with selective righteousness. And it really testifies to our collective failure globally to build a security architecture that would be less hostage to taking sides amongst these squabbling great powers, each with their own great power agenda. Now, what that would look like, I think, in more productive, practical terms, is thinking about a way in which there could be multilateral solutions. In the case of, you know, the eastern provinces of Ukraine, and some kind of, you know, governance that didn't involve America or NATO and Russia, getting control of these lands, but the kinds of things that have been proposed for other disputed territorial situations like Palestine. And so I think we do need to think about, in at least the long term, about how the Global South can really push us to reform the UN Security Council, empower the General Assembly, and really the United Nations more broadly, for the sake of a peace that is going to elude us as long as we're forced to pick sides between great powers.
Or, in fact, is that never really going to happen, obviously, because the United States holds the cards there, the UN headquarters in New York, and is the Global South now making its own arrangements, leaving the dollar, for instance, and making massive deals in the wake of the invasion of Ukraine? So seismic an event was it. And just forgetting about it. And as for all those human rights organizations that were seen as partisan, no matter how much of the good work Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, whatever, have done, their alliances and links to state, to Washington, it's disposed of. And it suits those in elite power in the Global South, but more generally, a feeling that this is the end of the US empire.
Well, there are a couple things to say in response to that really interesting question. One is just that there's a promising evolution in the non-governmental sector in response to this war. I've critiqued that sector in my work for merely monitoring how wars are conducted once they start, in the absence of any commitment to peace mobilization. But more broadly, of course, you're right that the United Nations reform isn't the only game in town. But while Putin is right about one thing in a recent speech, that this war is about whether and who accepts the passing of a unipolar world, we don't know the shape of a multipolar world and the exact institutions that ought to prevail. Of course, a multipolar world could be worse for humanity rather than better, but it could be better than the unipolar world we've experienced in the last 25 years. And I think it's an open question exactly whether it's the UN or some other set of institutions to be built or rebuilt in the name of progress and peace.
Well, one response arguably is this increased rhetorical attack, if not warship presence, against China. Very much so. That seems to be one big response from Washington.
That's completely true. And it's very easy to see that for all the hatred of Western elites for Donald Trump, they've followed him really in declaring a new era of confrontation with China, and really behind the Ukraine war, which shouldn't be, you know, treated as a sideshow, is this much larger specter of a new Cold War, which America and the West generally seem to be initiating against China. And I think if that happens, it will make our days of a local East European war seem relatively happy, because the original Cold War, global in scale, with most of the damage and violence visited outside Europe, was disastrous. And yet it seems as if the Ukraine war is in part, for all of its local significance, part of a kind of global reset of the West after some difficult years. It's inspired a lot of self-confidence among Western elites that they should resist the passing of unipolarity and even confront China to ensure that unipolarity remains alive and well. And that, I think, is chilling, because that kind of bellicosity has not gone well in the past.
Well, if the average worker doesn't have much time to look at the kind of things you do as a scholar, especially in a media landscape in NATO nations, which, as I say, is censored, as we so often say on this program, Julian Assange, who did expose lots of secrets, is, according to the UN, being tortured in Britain. What's it like as a scholar to work in this field, knowing that there are vested interests? And I know you make the point in your work that you try to be as independent as you can, given that there are vested interests in the field you're in, trying to pressure and not be as disinterested as they might appear to be, calling for that new war on China, which, you know, to some is already the richest country in the world by GDP purchasing power parity.
I think that there is a space in various, you know, countries for critiquing any new Cold War. And I think there's a substantial body of opinion that arose roughly over the years of Barack Obama's presidency, and especially Donald Trump's, that these great power wars ought to be resisted by a new kind of progressive internationalism. And it's not for nothing that the hashtag end endless wars became so hegemonic during Trump's administration that he himself began using it before he was booted off Twitter. I think the clearest evidence for that is that Joe Biden, for all of his own hawkish past, was compelled to choose to complete Trump's withdrawal from Afghanistan.
But he did. He did then go into Syria. Of course, he's in Syria right now.
It's a very complex picture, because in the speeches defending the Afghan withdrawal, Biden promised the continuation of the war on terror in the more secretive mode with armed drones and special forces that had actually transformed it already, starting in the later years of George W. Bush's presidency. And there was a lot of other more militarist choices under Biden. But my point is really about the rise of a kind of public exhaustion with endless war before Ukraine changed everything.
Yeah, I mean, I just finally and briefly,
where that goes.
I know you talk about Che Guevara being a great idol of one of the protagonists, Ratner, a prominent anti-war lawyer during the wars on terror. Of course, Guevara ended up in Moscow and in Beijing. Isn't that the new fight, the global fight with these great powers, but this time with the entire global South, much more, in a much more sophisticated fashion than it was during the Cold War or even in the non-aligned movement founded in Indonesia?
I think we are at the beginning with really the global South utterly pivotal once again of an attempt to imagine a progressive international movement. And it wouldn't just be concerned with war and peace, but also with distributional justice in a world that is still incredibly unequal and in which oligarchs rule in lots of places, including my country. So what exactly the form of that progressive international movement that seemed to be emerging, and I think will continue to do so, it remains opaque to me. I think that's in my defense because we're in the earliest days of its reemergement. And in a way, the demise of a unipolar moment does allow for some excitement about new alternatives. Now, what the relationship of that progressive movement is to great powers will remain to be determined. I think it should be much more skeptical of siding with one or another great power than was the case during the Cold War, which also allowed for neutralist alternatives and global southern alternatives that tried to sidestep the Cold War confrontation.
Professor Samuel Moyne, thank you. And that's it for the show. We'll be back next week with another brand new episode. But until then, you can still keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. But you can always head to the channel Going Underground TV on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you very soon.